careof.com. You know your body. We know science. Let's work together. Find the right vitamins, protein, and now collagen too. Personalized just for you. Healthy doesn't have to be hard. We make it easy. Take the quiz. Tell us a little about yourself. We're good listeners. Get nutrients at work. Get your personalized recommendation backed by science and delivered to you. Stick with it long term. Keep the conversation going. We'll adjust as your health needs change. A routine tailored to you. We'll help you create a health plan with vitamins, supplements, and more that help you feel your best today and support you long term. We're with you. Once you have your tailored plan, we'll help you stick with it, track your supplements, learn about how they work, and get new recommendations as your health changes, all in our handy app. Say hello to your new healthy habit. Honest guidance. We promise to be honest with you. That means we'll show you the research and be transparent about how established it is. We don't pretend all supplements have equal levels of scientific evidence or traditional history, because that isn't the truth, but we will always show our work and tailor our guidance to you as an individual. Better ingredients. Our research and development team has traveled the globe so we can provide the most effective, bioavailable, and sustainable ingredients possible. We're transparent about our supply chain because we build products we want to take, and then we deliver them straight to your door. Good morning. Hope you had a good week. Here's chapter 19 of American Dirt by Janine Cummins. Just on the outskirts of Guadalajara, inhaling the fragrance of chocolate, Lydia stops dead in her tracks. Her hand flies up to her mouth. Lorenzo turns to face her. Yeah, so I guess the daughter read the article your husband wrote. He says, "Oh my God," Lydia says, "you didn't know this?" Lydia's voice falters. "Yeah, somebody sent her the article, and when she read it, she freaked out and killed herself. Left her pappy a suicide note. Shit was ugly. That's why." Lydia's mind races to put the pieces together while the boy stereo talks. "That's why he went loco. Said you betrayed him and said your husband was responsible. Said you were all gonna pay. He was really fucked up." Wait, because her brain has seized, it's too full. Marta's isolated memory surged up in Lydia's consciousness, one after another, and then pop like bubbles. Javier in the bookstore, Skyping with his daughter in Barcelona before an exam. Her apprehension, his father's encouragement. Javier laughing when he told Lydia about the pogo stick Marta brought him for his 15th birthday. How he tried it out just to please her and ended up with his back in spasms. Javier's insistence that Marta was the only good thing he'd ever done in his life. Es mi cielo, mi luna, y todas mis estrellas. My sky, my moon, all my stars. There's an unwelcome pang in Lydia's chest. She didn't know about her father, about the cartel. I guess not. How could she not know? It seems so unlikely, but Lydia immediately perceives her own hypocrisy. She hadn't even known, either. The first domino of her understanding teeters and falls. Lorenzo shrugged. "I don't know, but he made your family like a straight-up vendetta. It was practically a press release for Los Jardineros. Usually when there's a job, you only hear what you need to hear, and it's only the people involved who know anything about it. But this time was different. Everybody in the city knew. Everybody in Guerrero." Lydia begins shuffling feet beneath her again, but her mind is swirling like a disengaged mower. She is blindsided. All this time, all these miles, the same futile, idiotic refrain kept presenting itself through her thoughts. This wasn't supposed to happen. It wasn't supposed to happen. She misjudged him. She had missed something. A thousand times she replayed the conversation she'd had with him, Sebastian. She'd had with Sebastian the night before the article came out. He'd asked if they should go to a hotel for a few days to be on the safe side. "No, I think we're fine," she told him. 100%. "Yes," she said, 100%. How that answer has haunted her. It has followed her into sleep every night. It has twisted in her gut without reprieve. all the frivolous reasons she hadn't wanted to go to the hotel. She hated to uproot Luca, for him to miss his school, for her business to suffer. She hated the interruption to their routine, and they believed truly that Javier wouldn't hurt them what she wouldn't give to go back to that moment with Sebastian to say anything else, to suck those words back in and obliterate them. 100%, she'd said. How presumptuous she'd been. How foolhardy. Of course, she couldn't count for every eventuality. Why hadn't she seen that sooner? She could never have predicted this, but she could have predicted that moment that something unpredictable might happen. Why, her body feels like cracked glass, already shattered and held in place only by a trick of temporary gravity. One wrong move and she will come to pieces. Marta's death changed everything, of course, it changed everything. Behind her shock, Lydia can sense waves of competing emotions, but she shuts them all down. De ninguna manera. She will feel nothing about Javier's dead daughter. No, Lydia will not even say her name. She will feel nothing about his anguish, to know he sent her at the Duquesa Imperial. I'm sorry for your pain and mine. Now we are bound forever in this grief. No, no. His grief is not the same as hers. Lydia will not feel empathy for him. She will rage. She will inhabit the fury of her own senseless bereavement, the one that Javier invented in for her. Instead, she will walk. She will leave him behind. She will repeat the 16 names of her murdered family. Innocents, all of them. Sebastian, especially an honorable man doing his job. She will list them and repeat them and remember. Sebastian, Yemi, Alex, Jennifer, Adrian, Paula, Arturo, Estefani, Nico, Joaquin, Diana, Vicente, Rafael, Lucia, and Rafael, Lita. Mama, repeat, her husband, her name, her sister, her niece, and her nephew, her aunt, her two cousins, all their beautiful children, her mama, Lydia, all will not stop saying their names. Lorenzo is saying something beside her, but his voice recedes behind her own recitation. She needs to be away from him. She will talk beside Luca. She will walk beside Luca instead, press his one finger to the palm of her hand. Her repetition will become a prayer. They pass into busy neighborhoods with curious dogs and kids riding bikes and women pushing strollers. Luca sees one man with a white cowboy hat riding an old pony and talking on a cell phone, which makes him laugh. There are also girls who look to be around the sisters' age who stand near the tracks in groups of two and three. They wear clothes that look like Mamie's underwear and white high heels or knee-high boots. They have neon pink lips and they call out to their countrymen in the Central American accents as they walk past. The girls invite the men to come have a beer or a smoke or a rest, and Luca knows there's something off about their appearance, their dress, something improper about their posture, so languorous against the bustle of the day. But he doesn't understand how it all works. He doesn't understand the difference between the men who shake their heads sadly and avert their eyes and the ones who leer and whistle, who trot off to disappear into darkened doorways with those young dress-up girls. When he tries to ask Mamie about them, she only shakes her head and squeezes his hand. Several times they pass clusters of uniformed men who rouse themselves when they notice the passing migrant. But each time this happens, Danilo removes the steel sheath machete from his shoulder and swings it alongside his body as he walks. He does some elaborate shuffle that passes for a dance and sings as they go, Guadalajara, Guadalajara, Tienes el alma de Provinciana, Vueles, Olimpio, a Rosa Temprana. When the men in the universe notice him, they return their interest elsewhere, so by the time they reach La Piedrera, Lydia feels as though Danilo has saved her life perhaps 7 times. She grips his hand and says thank you, but he shrugs it off and wishes them a safe continued journey. He turns and ambles back down the tracks as the way they came. They hear him singing as he goes, Guadalajara, Guadalajara, sabes al poor Sierra Mojada. I wish she would come with us all the way to El Norte, Rebecca says to Soledad as they watch him go. I can take care of you, Lorenzo says in response. This is his turn to look at him. Now we're all set, Rebecca says. Thanks. Lorenzo shrugs, but Soledad has no patience for this cholo and has never been a champion of Soledad anyway. She wheels on him. Are you still here? Did we invite you to join us or something? Because I don't remember doing that. Damn, girl. Calmate. We're all going to the same place, aren't we? Are we? I mean, what? You own Guadalajara now? She turns away. Come on, she says to Rebecca. The girls start to walk and Lucas with them. Lydia doesn't move. She knows Lorenzo could use that phone in his pocket to call Javier right now. He could slap her neck. He could snap her neck and then snap her picture. Collect a big reward. Her death could make him a heart and arrows hero. But isn't it possible that beneath that shield of his baby narco swago, he's also a scared boy alone in the world and running for his life? And isn't it also probably true that if he persists in not murdering them, he might know more things about the cartels that could help them? He's already been a wellspring, and Lydia would like the chance to interview him further, to pump him for more information. Luca and the girls look back at her friend from the corner they're about to turn. Luca is holding Rebecca's hand. The pace of their life has become so fast and so slow, Lydia never has enough time to make decisions. She works from instinct alone, and her instinct is strong in this instance. It tells her to get away from him. Can I ask you one thing, she asks. He shrugs. Do you think he's still looking for us? Sin duda alguna, he says, without a doubt. It's not surprising, but still there's no comfort in the validation. Her body feels leaden. But we're safer here, yes. Lorenzo's wearing a strings backpack. He squints and looks around. I don't know, he says. I mean, anywhere is safer than Acapulco, but he has alliances in other plazas. Claro que sí. There's a lot more cooperation with other cartels than there was before him. He's got reach deep into rival territories. Which ones, yes? I don't know. What do I look like? Some kind of maldito expert? Well, yes, she thinks. She moves her lips to one side. I'm just trying to determine our safest route. There is no safest route, far as I can tell, he says. You just gotta run like hell. She looks into his face, proud and young. His eyes are heavily lidden. His upper lip softened by a feeble crop of hair. He has the manners of a breakout high on one cheekbone. He is a veritable kid. Who has murdered at least three people? Lorenzo, you're not going to tell anyone, are you? She asks. She tries to anchor his gaze, but he looks away. Nah, I told you already. I'm done with all that. I'm out, he jams in his hands into the pockets of his shorts. She knows, Skibbe, thank you. Ni modo. It's an effort to turn her back to him because she is still afraid. The shock of a blade entering her flesh, severing her spine, the pile of her body in the road beside the tracks. Suerte, Lorenzo, she says. And she turns to go. It's even harder not to look back after he rejoins Luca and the sisters, but she knows he might interpret any backward glance as a weakness or an invitation, so she only imagines him falling behind. She pictures him following him. Pictures him falling from a hidden distance, but she doesn't turn to confront her suspiciousness. She keeps moving adelante. Keeps Luca and the girls moving. It's not until hours later on the doorstep of a migrant shelter that she accords herself a pause of reassurance. Just before she enters, she turns and allows her gaze to sweep up and down the vacant road to linger and search in every shadow and to thank God he is gone. They're exhausted by the time they arrive. They are good migrant services in the city. In between that and Danilo's modest heroics, the Hershey kisses, Luca has difficulty reconciling all the genuine kindness of strangers. It seems impossible that good people, so many good people, can exist in the same world where men shoot up whole families at birthday parties and then stand over their corpses and eat their fried and eat their chicken. There's a frazzling drama of confusion that arcs out of Lucas' brain when he tries to make those two facts sit side by side. At the shelter, Rebecca and Soledad stand guard for each other outside the bathroom door. It's a luxury to go slough the dust off the road of your skin to soap up and stand beneath a spray of warm water to watch it pool at your feet, grimy and brown, before it circles the drain and disappears forever. Soledad likes to think of the water molecules racing down the drain, but intermingling and dispersing, joining other pipes beneath the streets of the city, gathering volume and speed as they rush and rumble towards some unknown destination. She likes to think of the filth she washes from her skin, diluted and diluted until it no longer exists as filth at all. Although Soledad has the cell phone Yvonne gave her, she can't use it to make phone calls or texts because it has no credit. If it did have credit, Soledad still wouldn't use it for two reasons. First, except for her primo Cesar, no one knows she has a cell phone anyway. And second, like Lydia, she's afraid that if she uses a phone, Yvonne will then somehow be able to find her. So the phone functions mostly as a repository for the photographs, but also as a propeller that reminds Soledad how far she has come and how much better her life will be when she gets to El Norte. So when after the showers, the director of the casa asks them if they'd like to use the communication room to email or call anyone. The girl's excitement is almost too much to articulate. Finally, they can call Pappy. Rebecca has never used a phone before, never lifted a device to her ear and heard the familiar voice of a faraway loved one. Soledad has never initiated a call. It's an ordinary modern convenience that for the sisters still carries the full weight of the miraculous. How do we do it? Rebecca asks her sister after the director has shown them into the quiet room and closed the door behind them. Soledad frowns. Get Luca. The room is small and it contains a desk with a glowing computer, one rolling office chair, and a small floor print couch. The phone sits on the desk beside the monitor. Rebecca turns quickly with Luca, who sits down at the computer and asks the sisters for the name of the hotel where her father works and finds the phone number within seconds. He writes it down on the lone yellow notepad, but then he stands to go. Soledad asks him to dial it too. What's your father's name? He asks, covering the mouth space as the line rings in his ear. Elmer. Soledad says, ask for Elmer Barca Lobo in the main kitchen. So Luca does, but as he prepares to go, immediately hand the phone over to Soledad. The receptionist, I'm sorry, but Elmer isn't working today. Hold on. Luca hears the sound of her voice muffled for a moment before she returns speaking clearly. Can I ask who's calling? She says, I'm here with his dogs. I was just putting in a call for them. I see, she says. Hold on, I'll put Soledad on, Luca says. He hands the phone to Soledad, who takes his seat, her face brightening in nervous anticipation. She hopes Pepe won't be angry with him. She hopes he'll understand that why they had to leave the way they did, without warning, without a proper goodbye. She's been haunted these last weeks by the thoughts of him coming home alone to the darkened apartment, exhausted from a double shift, and finding her note. She's tried not to think about the anguish it might have caused him. She bites her lip. Hello, she says. Hello, a woman's voice on the line, still the receptionist. You're calling for Elmer? Is this Elmer's daughter? Yes, it's Soledad. Is he there? May we speak with him? I'm afraid Elmer's not working right now, Soledad. Soledad's shoulders slump, and she leans back in the chair. Okay, she says. Can we leave the message for him? It's an important message, and I don't know when we'll have an opportunity to use the telephone again. I'm here with my sister Rebecca, and we want to tell him we're okay. So Soledad, the woman said. Just that, use her name, Soledad. But something about the hesitation in those three syllables makes Soledad's stomach drop. She straightens up in the chair. I'm sorry, but your father will be back to work for quite some time. Soledad grabs the edge of the desk and turns her back to her sister. Mika reaches for the doorknob, but Soledad puts a hand on the shoulder. Her mouth is open, but she refuses to ask the questions that will lead to her enlightenment. She doesn't want to know. I'm sorry, Soledad, but your father had an accident. Not an accident. Your father, he's in the hospital. Soledad clamps her knees together and stands up, sending the chair rolling away. Why? What happened? Rebecca stands up then, too, and Lika moves next to her. Is he okay? Soledad asks. The woman's voice is low. I think he's stable, but that was the last we heard. Soledad takes one breath. Stable? But what happened? He was attacked coming into work last week. She moves to close into the chair again, but the chair is no longer behind her, and she almost falls on the floor. Luca grabs the chair and rolls it over. She sits. He was stabbed, the woman is saying. I'm so sorry. Which hospital? El Nacional. I'm sorry, Soledad. Soledad hangs up the phone, and it takes Luca less than 1 minute to find the number for the Hospital Nacional in San Pedro Sula. Again, he dials for them, but this time he hits the speakerphone button so they can all hear. At 1,360 miles away in the ICU unit in a six-story green and blue building, a nurse wearing clean white scrubs and a blue stethoscope darts into the nurse's station and tosses the chart into the cluttered desk. Look at Rebecca, so I'll hear her pick up the phone. They lean forward. I think my father was there, Soledad says. Her voice sounds swollen and cobwebby in her ears. My father, Elmer Abarca Lobo. The woman at his work told us he was there since last week. They can hear things clicking and peeping in the background. Voices, a child crying. The nurse does not immediately reply. Hello, Rebecca says. I'm looking, the nurse replies. There are folders, charts. She's flipping through them. Soledad's hand darts over and grabs her sister's across the desk. Together, their knuckles turn hard and shiny. A woman at his work told us he was stabbed. Oh, as if the nurse suddenly remembers. Yes, Elmer, she says. He's here. He's not in great shape. I'm afraid he's stable now. He lost a lot of blood. Rebecca clamps her free hand over her mouth. Soledad digs her fingers into the skin of her face, her lower jaw. Can we speak with him? No, he's not conscious, the nurse says. Can you come in? Rebecca shakes her head, but Soledad answers out loud. We're not in Honduras, she explains. We're in Mexico. Rebecca is stuck on a different detail. What do you mean he's not conscious? What does that mean? It means we have him sleeping right now but because of the damage to his brain. He needs to sleep until the swelling and trauma are under control. Soledad pitches forward, curling her body over her knees. Damage to his brain, Rebecca says. I understand. Yes, the nurse says. He was stabbed in the face. Oh my God, both girls begin to cry. Luca is shifting his weight over ever more rapidly from foot to foot. He backs away from the phone until he's leaning against the wall beside the door. He was stabbed once in the stomach and twice in the face. The nurse keeps talking. She's not oblivious to the sister's pain, but she knows she has to impart this information. And it's better to do it quickly, like ripping off a band-aid, so they can move on to the next part, where they already know all the awful information and can begin to process it. The stab wound that did the most damage was to the right side of his infraorbital region. Infraorbital, what is that? Asks Oda. Please speak simply. Even the most hardened trauma nurse in the most violent city in the world would have difficulty conveying this detail to the family. His eye, she explains. They stabbed him in the eye, Soledad asks. Yes, the nurse says. Oh my God, Rebecca says again. Yes, the nurse says. She tells him he's resting comfortably, but that he's stable, but they will keep him in a medically induced coma until the doctor feels it safe to wake him up. She doesn't know how long that will be. She warns them that the stab wounds were significant and that there may be lasting damage to his brain. She explains that there's no way to assess that damage until the initial period of rest and healing has concluded. Gross, the nurse says quietly, and they hear a door close on her end of the line, followed by a peripheral silence. Do you know who did this to your father? Soldat let out a sob and then answers, Yes, I do. Rebecca's black eyes grow even wider and darker, a storm on her face. Listen to me, the nurse says then. I need you to listen carefully. Both girls breathe reagedly. They are shaking. Don't you dare come back here, he says. Don't even think about it. Do you hear me? Their faces are wet. Their noses filled with snot and tears. Rebecca sniffs loudly and lets the small cry loose into the room. He's getting the best care possible, Kay, the nurse says. There's a catch on her voice, too. We are doing everything we can to make him well again, and if you come back here just to sit in our waiting room and wring your hands and cry and get yourselves both stabbed in the eye, too, well, it's not going to do him one bit of good, you understand? They did not answer. How old are you girls? 15, Soledad says. 14, says Rebecca. Good, your pappy wants you to live until you are 100 years old, okay? You cannot do that if you come back here. Keep going. In San Pedro Sula at the Hospital Nacional, they can hear the nurse blowing her nose. My name, Angela. My name's Angela. Call me again next time you get to a phone, and I'll give you an update. Thank you, Rebecca says. The nurse clears her throat. I'll tell your father you called. After they hang up, they stay in the room without speaking. Soledad stands up and sits down and stands up again at least 10 times. Rebecca sits on the edge of the couch and shreds a Kleenex into pulp. Luca does not move. He hopes the sisters will forget he's there. He hopes they won't speak to him or ask anything of him. He needs to get out of this room but cannot move. His pippy is dead. Luca lifts a hand to touch the red brim of his dead father's hat. He pitches pippy on the back patio of a boy's house without nurses or buggers or peeping machines that might save him. He pictures the silence of pooling blood. Luca stands there and blends into the wall. Soon there's a knock on the door. Soledad is grateful for the knock, as it gives her something outside her body to attend to. She opens the door. About finished, a staff counselor stands in the hallway with another migrant. There's a 15-minute time limit when people are waiting. Yes, sorry, Soledad said. We'll be right out. Luca slips out just before the counselor closes the door. Inside, Soledad whispers, I'm sorry. What? Rebecca looks up from her tormented Kleenex. I'm sorry, it's my fault, Rebecca, forgive me. Rebecca moves across a small space and throws her arms around Soledad so her rainbow wristband presses against the still wet blotches of her sister's hair. Shh, she says, it's all my fault, Soledad says over and over again. And then finally Rebecca pushes back from her and shakes her roughly by her two shoulders. Don't be ridiculous, it's no one's fault. Only ese hijo de puta. Soledad crumbles even smaller into her sister's arms. But I had to make a horrible choice, she cries. It was you or Pappy. I knew that. I knew we were putting him in danger if we left. Yvonne warned me. I didn't really think he'd go through with it. I thought if we left, she doesn't bother finishing the sentence because it doesn't matter what she thought. She was wrong. Sisters take two shaky breaths together, and Rebecca wipes Soledad's tears with her thumbs. Stop, Rebecca says. Stop it, Sol. Pappy would have made the same choice. When he's better, he'll be so proud of you. He'll see. Soledad dries her face with a fresh Kleenex. She blows her nose. You're right. You'll be okay. Rebecca says he has to. Into the clicking, beeping silence of Pappy's popular room in San Pedro Sula, the nurse enters solemnly in her white sneakers. She had known his name, of course, because of the identification they found in his wallet, but there had been no visitors, no inquiries until today. Sometimes it's easier that way. You can provide the care of the patient needs, manage his pain, and administer to his broken body without the weight of additional sorrow. Angela has been a nurse in this city long enough to know that the pain of the family often eclipses the pain of the patient. It's relatively quiet in the ward this evening, so after she checks his vitals and changes his waist bag, Angela has time to sit with him. It's still light out, but she turns on the table lamp anyway because she finds its soft glow comforting. She closes her eyes briefly before she speaks to him. Her colleagues don't do this anymore because it's too taxing, too heavy. Angela is the only one. The violence is overwhelming in this place now. It's become a gang pageant of blood and grisly one-upmanship. The ICU is always busy, but it's not as overcrowded as the morgue. The other nurses use irreverent humor to cope. They use a secret radio system of smiley faces to forecast the patient's chances A survival angel does a suggestion for they have to go home to their children. But at the end of their shifts, they want to stay married. They want to eat dinner and drink a beer in the yard with the neighbors. But after 20 years on the job, Angela still can't shut it off. She doesn't even want to. She pulls a chair closer to Elmer's bedside and lifts his hand, careful not to disturb his IV line. She rubs the back of his hand with her thumb. Elmer, your daughter's called today. She says, quite Soledad and Rebecca called from Mexico, and they're doing well. Elmer, your daughters are okay. They're on their way to El Norte. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe. Thank you.